Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Amid increasing job losses across our region, some folks are asking, can ginseng farming play a larger role in the Appalachian economy?
I'm selling the ginseng in bulk at $2,000 a pound.
That's a good markup, sir.
Well, it is. You see, I'm just catching in on what the Hong Kong Chinese are doing.
Others are turning to brewing craft beer as another way to make a living.
A few short years ago, there was only maybe 7 or 8 different breweries in West Virginia. This year, there's going to be 12. Next year, there's even more slated to open. So.
And the bourbon business is booming. But distillers say they need more people to be building whiskey barrels.
Some of them call and say, I'm making whiskey. I've got my stills going and I need barrels. And I didn't think there would ever be a problem getting barrels.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. The war on coal, pressures from natural gas development, crumbling infrastructure, whatever you want to blame it on, jobs are becoming more and more scarce these days in communities dependent on coal. As a result, some folks are hoping to build and encourage new industries among the hills and hollers. But with change comes challenges, roadblocks, and complications. On this show, we'll hear some of these stories. Let's start with Sang. You see, some folks are reaching back to their roots, literally and figuratively, to make ends meet, just as they have for generations. And there's some big money there, especially harvesting ginseng. But can plants like ginseng play a significant role in our economy today? It's a question Glynis Board of West Virginia Public Broadcasting tackled in this, the first of two reports.
The top five counties last year were Mingo, Wyoming, Logan, Randolph, and McDowell.
Robin Black is West Virginia Division of Forestry's ginseng coordinator. For over 25 years, her role has been to monitor the ginseng industry. She says last year, over 7,000 pounds were harvested. At last year's average price of $750 a pound, $5.5 million came into the state.
The miners use that ginseng that they harvest during the season to help pay bills, give them a Christmas, and that kind of stuff. So in the southern coal fields, yeah, that's a big extra money that they can get during a small time period.
But can ginseng play a more significant role in our economy? To answer that question, we have to understand some of the driving economic factors, the most important being that the most valuable roots in the world are those that grow in Appalachian forests. Ecologist and Eberly Professor of Biology at West Virginia University, Jim McGraw, has been studying the plant for decades.
Wild plants tend to grow really slowly, and their whole life history is very slow, so it takes a long time for them to even get big enough to produce a single seed.
See, wild sang, that is the good stuff. That's the root that Asian markets will pay top dollar for, just as it has for the past 300 years. But ginseng can also be planted and cultivated.
In the opposite extreme, with extreme cultivation like happens in Wisconsin and Ontario, plants grow very quickly to adult size and 2 to 3 years, you can have plants producing seeds and be quite large.
The thing is, you can really tell when sang has been cultivated. The root is all swollen, fat, white, and smooth compared to wild sang, which is scrawny, tortured, and dark. But some mountain folk have found that planting the seed in a more natural or wild setting produces a root that will fetch a more competitive price.
But these forest-grown plants, where people are actually planting seeds in the woods, they tend to be a little bit more like wild, but it depends what they do to them. So if they prepare the ground, for example, with a tiller, and they plant in a tilled area, those plants will grow faster because they've eliminated competition from other neighboring herbs and so forth.
So depending on the growing techniques, this forest-grown ginseng crop could be a game changer, according to industry experts, academics, and others involved with ginseng. Larry Harding is one example of someone who's made a comfortable living forest growing. He shows off one of his forest-grown roots.
There's not a person on earth who could say that's not wild ginseng, but it's not wild ginseng. We planted that ginseng, so You know, that's ginseng that we planted here on the farm.
Harding's father started his ginseng farm 50 years ago, just outside of Friendsville, Maryland. That's just over the West Virginia border. Now, the laws are a little different in Maryland, but Harding says each year he harvests anywhere from 500 to 2,000 pounds of dry ginseng from the over 80 acres of his steep, forested land. It's enough to provide Harding's main source of income. And the price he can get for his forest-grown root compared to wild root?
The difference in price, when you're talking about root like this, little to none. You know, so, this is wild quality root.
Harding markets his product as having wild characteristics, taste, color, and texture. He says it's the quality of this forest-grown sang that fetches funds comparable to that of wild sang.
So, if when you hear the word ginseng, you think of a wild plant that grows great in the hills and hollers of Appalachia, you're right. But now we know a little bit more about forest-grown ginseng. It's basically ginseng farms in the forest that can yield roots as valuable as the wild stuff. So, is it a viable business for West Virginians? Well, in the second report, Glynis Board found out there are some rules and regulations that might hinder this option in the state.
Here in West Virginia and in many areas of Appalachia, the same rules that exist to protect wild ginseng plants are often applied to forest-grown plants. Ginseng researcher and Eberly Professor of Biology at West Virginia University, Jim McGraw, says that's problematic. He explains a lot of these regulations were conceived of with the best intentions to try to ensure that wild plants would have the opportunity to mature and reproduce. But McGraw says even for wild populations, a lot of current regulations are missing the mark. Take, for example, the Maine ginseng rule. The plants must be at least 5 years old to harvest.
We know from our long-term monitoring of wild populations that over 90% of the plants at age 5 years have never produced a single seed. And so that five-year age limit does nothing to assure us that plant has replaced itself.
So that means 5 years may not be long enough to help preserve wild populations. But for farmed ginseng, experts say an age limit may not be necessary at all. That's why farmers pushed back a decade ago when federal regulators tried to say the plant needed to be at least 10 years old instead of 5 to legally harvest and export. Robin Black at the Division of Forestry remembers how forest growers threw down. 10 years was too long to wait for a return on their investment, farmers said. And what if, in that time, ginseng was deemed illegal to export altogether, which is exactly what happened in Canada.
We started the Ginseng Growers Program in 2006 out of the request for a group called the West Virginia Ginseng Growers Association. The ginseng growers came to us wanting to be able to grow ginseng on their own property so that if and when, if it ever happens, that the ginseng season would ever be closed in the state of West Virginia, those people that are legally growing it and registered with the state would be able to export that ginseng out of the country and out of state.
To date, there are about 70 registered growers in West Virginia, but it's a struggling industry because of market insecurities, regulations, poaching, and enforcement woes. But Jim McGraw says research today is shedding new light on ways to effectively build up the ginseng industry, especially regarding this forest-grown farming method. McGraw believes reworking regulations while thinking about forest-grown crops could allow residents to take advantage of this valuable commodity and conserve wild populations. And there are other steps we could take. McGraw says West Virginia could benefit enormously, for example, with a native ginseng seed bank.
Right now, forest plot growers are mainly having to buy seed from Wisconsin and other kind of cultivated sources. But we'd really rather have them using local sources of seeds. And this is something that could be stimulated. For example, we have a stocking program for fish, right? Mm-hmm. Why not a stocking program through our beautiful College of Agriculture to produce seeds for local growers from local wild populations?
Current regulations prohibit collecting wild seed, but McGraw thinks a better way to protect what exists might be to invest in it. McGraw says creating a new permit program would be a simple way to make that possible.
And so by whatever mechanism, whether it's private enterprise or a government thing, we need local seed sources, and that's just not available right now. But I actually think that's an opportunity for sort of branding this whole thing too. And we could imagine a West Virginia ginseng that gets branded just like Vermont maple syrup gets branded and sold to Asia in a way that really economically benefits our residents of our state.
A seed bank and a permit program are just a couple of McGraw's suggestions. But other ideas to bolster the industry also exist. A group out of Pennsylvania, for example, just launched a certification program that would create standards for the plant from seed to harvest. But while good ideas and some movement is encouraging for industry stakeholders, the stakes remain high. McGraw and many other experts agree that in West Virginia, with habitat loss, deer browsing, and increases in illegal harvesting techniques, the commodity could just as easily be altogether lost if we do nothing to change current trends. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
Across the country, it's illegal to pull ginseng from national parks. This form of poaching is yet another challenge for those working to develop more sustainable practices for the ginseng industry. So folks in North Carolina have come up with a way to help detect if a root has been poached from illegal land. In this next report, Greta Johnson of WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina, reports on the fight to prevent poaching.
There are no flat paths in this part of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Wild ginseng thrives in shady spots like this, where foliage is dense with bushes and trees, and briars.
Ooh, ow!
That'll bite you. Should have warned you.
That's Jim Corbin, a plant protection specialist with the state's Agriculture Department. He's out to protect ginseng from poachers who come into the park to dig up ginseng root, which is a federal crime. He leads me through the woods for about half an hour before we spot our first plant.
Yes, son. We did luck out, didn't we? You know what ginseng looks like?
It's short, up to our shins, and has little red seeds like tiny cranberries. Corbin crouches down and digs his finger into the soil near the root, then pulls a spray can and a little jar of thick yellow powder out of his pocket.
It also puts a glue, stick them on it, so the chips will seat on there, and then that color will stain that.
That powder is Corbin's anti-poaching technology. So if someone digs up the root he's marked and tries to sell it, it'll glow under a black light, revealing it was poached. Park officials say Corbin's dye has helped convict 41 ginseng poachers in the last 4 years. One was Billy Joe Hurley. He pled guilty to his fourth poaching conviction earlier this fall. He's serving 5.5 months in federal prison. Hurley's lawyer, Corey Atkins, is sympathetic to his client and other locals who do the same thing.
They're not out there robbing little old ladies. They're just trying to make a living doing something that they're really good at.
Atkins says ginseng digging is an Appalachian tradition.
If you grew up in this area in the South, you knew a lot of people that did it, and it wasn't necessarily seen as criminal.
And traditional diggers aren't the problem. Over the last couple of years, a new kind of digger has arrived on the scene, says Roddy Gable with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This newer sort of craze that we see sensationalized on television and stuff with people running out to make quick money digging ginseng, those sort of Johnny-come-lately diggers are not steeped in the tradition of the older ginseng diggers who have these good practices that their father or grandfather, whoever, taught them. And that's the concern we have.
Good practices include waiting until fall, when plants have reproduced, and only harvesting plants older than 5 years old. But the prize for wild ginseng is too tempting to wait.
Well, I paid almost up to $225.
That's Robert Itis. He's one of 50 registered ginseng dealers in North Carolina. He's the middleman between diggers and bigger dealers who export the roots to Hong Kong. That $225 is the dollars he'll pay per pound for fresh wild ginseng roots.
I'm selling the ginseng in bulk at $2,000 a pound.
That's a good markup, sir.
Well, it is. You see, I'm just catching in on what the Hong Kong Chinese are doing.
He says those same plants will go for more than $20,000 in Hong Kong. U.S. Fish and Wildlife numbers show a big jump in exports of wild ginseng between 2012 and 2013. Prices were more than $2,000 a kilo, and exports were up nearly 40%. That's what Corbin is up against as the Ginseng Guardian drives through the mountains out of the park after another day's work marking ginseng roots. He says his efforts are about protecting the biodiversity here.
Well, you have to say, any time you remove any organism from a biome, you basically damage that biome. And yeah, I think it's worth it.
He says all he wants is for ginseng to be around for the next two or three generations. For NPR News, I'm Greta Johnson.
That story first aired on NPR's Weekend Edition last November. This is Inside Appalachia. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry, Inside Appalachia is available in a podcast. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, and WVPublic.org, so you can rewind and listen on your own time.
I was born on a farm on Big Soul Mountain, and I lived with my daddy.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Picture this. You're out taking a winter walk along a country road, and a small flock of dark gray birds flies up in front of you. They utter a few sharp chip notes, and you notice that they flash white on the edges of their tails as they flit away in all directions. They're known as dark-eyed junco, and they're the focus of this segment of Bird Files by the Allegheny Front. Here's ornithologist Bob Mulvihill of the National Aviary.
Some people call them snowbirds, and not because they fly to Florida for the winter. They are harbingers of winter, often making their first appearance with the first snowfall. You may be surprised to learn that this ordinary little bird scratching for seeds under your bird feeder has had an extraordinarily important role in scholarly studies in biology for more than 70 years. Dr. Ellen Ketterson is a researcher from Indiana University who recently produced a film called The Ordinary Extraordinary Junco. She describes the junco as a rock star for scientists who study animal behavior, ecology, and evolutionary biology. Indeed, generations of researchers have addressed complex questions simply by studying the junco. Take migration. Each fall, female juncos leave their Canadian breeding grounds before the males, and ultimately they fly much farther south. Because of this, the first juncos you see in Pennsylvania in mid-October will be the smaller, lighter gray and browner females. By early November, most of the females have flown south, and more of the larger, darker gray males begin arriving. Unlike the transient females, though, most of the males remain here. By this time of year, when they're all through sorting themselves out, almost three-quarters of the juncos visiting feeders in Pennsylvania and points north will be males, while a similar proportion of the juncos wintering in the southeastern U.S. will be females. But why? For one thing, by wintering farther north, males have shorter distances to return to their nesting grounds in the spring. This means they can arrive earlier, which helps when there's competition to stake out breeding sites. Because males tend to battle over territories, larger size helps them to be competitive. But larger size also gives males the ability to winter farther north. This has to do partly with Bergman's rule, one of those textbook ecology principles you may remember from biology class. It's the one that states that within a species or a group of closely related species, individuals in northern areas that are colder will tend to be larger. That's because the bigger the bird, the greater its ability to conserve heat. So larger males are better suited for cold winters. Now maybe it makes more sense why female juncos winter farther south than males. And that's just one of many extraordinary things that scientists have learned about this ordinary little bird.
That was ornithologist Bob Mulvihill of the National Aviary for Bird Files. Thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the bird calls heard in the Bird Files story by the Allegheny Front. Fights over playground turf are taking on new meaning at some schools. That's because Marcellus gas drillers are leasing land nearby, and the plans are earning an F with parents. Gas drillers are putting their wells closer to schools, in some cases less than 1,000 feet, and many school districts have begun leasing their land to drillers. But this doesn't sit well with some parents, leading to skirmishes. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Last week, Joanne Wagner got what, for her, is good news. The drilling company Range Resources withdrew its application to drill near the Fort Cherry schools, where her children go. The company already developed one well nearby. The latest plan would have added three more.
Our school ultimately would be completely surrounded by wells.
Citing low oil and gas prices, the company said it was backing off its drilling plans. Fort Cherry, a small district southwest of Pittsburgh, is one of many school districts where drilling rigs are becoming commonplace. Sometimes it's on neighboring properties, but sometimes the schools themselves have signed leases with the gas companies. This has helped school budgets, but it's got some parents, like Wagner, a school board member, on edge.
There are places for it, but it is not near 1,200 children at a school.
A Range Resources spokesman did not respond to interview requests, but in a written statement, he said the company hoped to restart drilling there next year. He says the district's own study showed no air quality problems at the school during the fracking process at a previous well. But these results don't sway Pittsburgh pediatrician Edward Kattire. He says some hazardous air pollutants can be released during fracking. And because of this, the process should be kept far from children.
You know, children are not little adults. Children are different. They're more susceptible to toxic chemicals because of their size and because of the normal processes of growth and development.
And uncertainty about health impacts led New York State to ban fracking late last year.
Hey, can you find his toy? Oh, I think we left.
Crystal Yost is a stay-at-home mother with children in the Mars Area School District, just north of Pittsburgh. Rex Energy wants to drill a well a half mile from her daughter's school.
Way too close.
Scientists have found health impacts as far as 10 miles from fracking wells. Those are preliminary studies, and the industry has criticized their methods. But they give parents like Yost pause. She thinks her neighbors should have the right to lease their land, but she says there's a limit.
But when it starts to, you know, come onto my property and when my kids breathe it, my kids are going to be evacuated or potentially preparing for an evacuation because of what you've done with your property, I think that's where my rights begin and yours stop.
Yost and other parents are fighting the placement of the wells, and it could be a lengthy legal process. At a local fire hall, a few hundred people crammed in for a hearing on the wells. Kim Geyer and her husband own the land where they would be drilled.
The state's required setback is 500 feet, and we're three times that. So this really has nothing to do with the school district.
Geyer, who's a former school board member, says the issue is property rights. She thinks hers are being squeezed by the local parent group.
Well, we live on a farm. We're following the laws. I mean, if people have a problem with that, then they need to go to Harrisburg and change the laws.
As it happens, new Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf is reviewing the state's oil and gas regulations. Among the rules he could try to change are setbacks for oil and gas wells from schools. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Hear that? Eh? That means it's time for What's in a Name. We're experimenting with theme music for this segment. This week, we're going to a town in southern West Virginia that's also nicknamed the Dogwood City and is often called Home of Champions in basketball after claiming several state high school titles before consolidation in 1997. Here's a hint. I was once on the sidelines in uniform cheering on the team. We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So what town is known as the Dogwood City and often referred to as Home of Champions in high school basketball? Mullins, West Virginia. This one has an interesting story behind it, and to help us out this week is Wyoming County Circuit Clerk David Bugs Stover. Yet again, there are two stories behind the town of Mullins.
Mr. Mullins wanted to own a farm where Mullins is now, and he spelled his name M-U-L-L-I-N-S. The story is, it's even on that sign up there, that he apparently forgot to dot his I, and he looped his I, like a lot of people do, and left it off and people for then after assumed that was an E and named it Mullins, M-U-L-L-E-N-S. Now, I happen to have found the records here, being the circuit clerk, of when that group of people living up there got together and decided to incorporate their town. On the very same documents, he often spelled his name with what looked like an E and what looked like an I, which probably explains what happened. One of those inadvertent things.
Stover points out that most towns in the region, like much of Appalachia, were named by the postmaster. It was important to have a unique name so the mail didn't get mixed up.
There is the story that down at what is now New Richmond, when they sent off to find out if they could name it Mullins, there was a postmaster there named Mullins, M-U-L-L-E-N-S, and they thought how clever and sneaky a way to get the name the town named after M-U-L-L-E-N-S, them, instead of M-U-L-L-I-N-S, the guy who actually owned the farm that made the town. My guess, that probably didn't happen. My guess, since I saw the documents, and there he spelled it differently himself.
Want to suggest a town name that we explore on Inside Appalachia? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag what's in a name. We started this episode looking at how some Appalachians are getting back to their roots to earn a living by digging ginseng. But as we heard, ginseng diggers know they can earn more money for wild ginseng, and farming ginseng that brings in that type of income takes patience and skill. Now, here's another niche industry that is also on the rise, freshly roasted coffee, made by craft coffee roasters. Yes, we do know that coffee doesn't grow in Appalachia, but more and more people are getting into the craft of freshly roasted coffee, which can even be done on site now in some coffee shops. Why all the effort? After all, coffee's so popular that many people don't even care if it's cheap or low quality, as long as they have their caffeine fix. But as Liz McCormick of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports, more and more people are searching for that higher quality coffee only found in the specialty shops.
So, Brian, what are you about to do right now?
I'm about ready to fire up Plutonius. That's the drive belt. Everything is run from this motor here. This machine could have run on steam power, water power, anything that can turn that belt can run this machine.
That's Brian Bircher. He's roasting imported green coffee beans using a massive roaster built in 1931 called Plutonius. This 7.5-foot tall roaster was manufactured by a coffee company called Jabez Burns & Sons in New York City. According to the company's records, this model was the last one made, and Bircher says it's one of four he's been able to find still in use today.
I first met Plutonius, and we have a long history together. I lived in Leesburg back in 1986 in a little apartment over top of a store. And in 1986, a business moved in there called the Coffee Bean. And they owned Plutonius at the time, and they moved it into that building. So I used to go down and watch them roast coffee. I always joke that this is probably where I caught the bug, because I used to watch people, you know, work on this machine.
Bircher opened his own coffee roasting shop in 2006 in West Virginia, first out of his garage and then at a bigger permanent location in 2011. But in 2010, the Leesburg Coffee Bean closed, and the massive roaster, Plutonius, was headed to the Smithsonian. After learning this, Bircher went after the roaster and bought it. In 2012, he began using Plutonius full-time to roast all of the coffee beans in his shop.
Yeah, I would say our maximum capacity on this machine, we could do 1,000 pounds a day if we needed to.
Bircher's specialty coffee shop, Black Dog Coffee, is located in Jefferson County. It's a popular stop on Route 9 between Charlestown and Martinsburg, and its mascot is, you guessed it, a big black dog.
There's some periods of the road.
Bircher says what makes his product special is its freshness.
I thought that I was sort of a coffee snob. I was buying, you know, higher quality coffee and brewing with spring water through a gold filter, grinding right before brewing, all doing all the right things. But what I didn't realize was so important with coffee is freshness. Coffee, it's at its peak of flavor within the first 10 to 14 days after you roast it. When I tasted that, it just really knocked my socks off.
Bircher claims most of the coffee beans and pre-ground coffee people buy from grocery stores may have gone stale months before even hitting the shelves. So if freshness is the key to a truly good cup of coffee, why do so many people still buy the inexpensive or low-quality brands we see in stores?
just because a lot of people like very high quality doesn't mean that everybody understands or subscribes to that.
That's Brian Floyd. He's the executive director of the Pierpont Culinary Academy at Pierpont Community and Technical College in Fairmont.
I would liken coffee shops to also the proliferation of local farmers markets and local food production. People have a little more of a connection to not only the product, but to the proprietor or to the people that are frequenting that. And, you know, coffee, while being roasted locally, means that somebody's taking a specific interest in that, and you might get to know that particular somebody versus it just coming from a warehouse somewhere.
Ellen Allen is the executive director of the Covenant House in Charleston, but she also identifies as a coffee connoisseur.
I just love the richness, the boldness, and Liz, I started drinking coffee when I was like 4 or 5 years old. It's not an acquired taste. It's something I loved immediately.
Allen says she always chooses specialty and local coffee shops similar to the Black Dog Coffee Company, even if she has to go out of her way to get it.
Just sipping it and enjoying it, understanding even where it comes from. It's more of an experience than just, you know, quenching a thirst. It's a wonderful experience to enjoy a fresh roasted cup of coffee from freshly roasted beans. And the tastes are so different from, you know, growing up as a kid who had Folgers to drinking a cup of coffee that, you know, came from a family farm perhaps in, you know, South America at beans grown at 4,000 feet. You know, it's just different as night and day.
You can hear the sound change of the airflow. Now it's pulling air through the cooling system.
The Black Dog Coffee Company, as well as other specialty shops across the state, continue to see a growing number in the amount of people they serve. While there may always be a coffee section in grocery stores, the trend in specialty shops is on the rise. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Shenandoah Junction.
From coffee and now on to another trending drink with deep traditional roots, bourbon. If you make a lot of bourbon whiskey, you could distill a lot of profit. That's because bourbon sales in the U.S. are booming, up 36% in the last 5 years. But to age your new pristine product, you need new wooden barrels. As NPR's Noah Adams reports from Kentucky, these barrels are becoming more precious than the bourbon.
It's a very old craft, a skill, almost an art. It's called cooperage. The Scots-Irish, who settled in Appalachia, could do this. Cut the white oak boards into staves, steam them to bend, make metal hoops to hold the barrel tight. And coopering is now an industry. The barrels are made in factories. Inside, the air smells of fresh cut wood, and you can almost see the sounds. This cooperage is one of several owned by a company called Independent Stave. It's based in Missouri, and it's the largest maker of whiskey barrels in the world. We've come to see the process in the small town of Lebanon, Kentucky. As the barrels take shape, they are carried, rolled, and conveyed, sometimes overhead, to the different workstations. Starting out as a collection of oak staves, they are fitted together, steamed, bound with steel, seared with flame. The barrels arrive at the end, ready for inspection.
The barrel has water and air in it. They're looking for any kind of leak or defect in the barrel. He's going to fix that barrel. It's leaking. He's going to put a plug in that barrel where it's leaking, a small plug in it, to stop that leak.
The plug is a simple piece of cedar whittled by hand. We're talking with Leo Smith. He's the supervisor for the last stop on the production line.
They let the air and water out, drain the water. Then it goes to this gentleman down here for another final inspect. And then they go on to the trailers, to the distilleries.
Independent Stave is a family-owned company, and they don't talk much. I can't ask how many people work here in Kentucky, how many barrels they make. But the plant manager, Barry Shoemaker, does say in the last 2 years, production has doubled.
There's two shifts a day, 6 o'clock in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And at night, we start at 8 o'clock, and we work till 4:30 in the morning. We've seen an increase, and it looks like there's no end in sight.
This company, Independent Stave, makes barrels for the big distilleries, Kentucky brand names you might have tasted. And so far, Independent is staying steady with demand. But there's another need for oak barrels. If you're a very small company starting to make bourbon or vodka, gin, rum, yours is called a craft distillery. Your output is low. It's kind of like a drop compared to the big brands. But somebody does have to make you some barrels.
My name is Kevin McLaughlin. I'm joint president of Kelvin Cooperage.
And I'm Paul McLaughlin, also joint president of Kelvin Cooperage.
We're both interchangeable. We're a team.
This is Kevin and Paul McLaughlin. The brothers moved here from Scotland. They own the Kelvin Cooperage in Louisville. For more than 20 years, they've been crafting wine barrels and buying used bourbon barrels to fix up and sell to the whiskey trade in Scotland and Ireland. But now this different market has come right to them. They're making white oak barrels for the newly rising craft distillers. Paul McLaughlin takes me to watch the charring process. They put oak scraps in the finished barrel, and soon you'll see the flames. In the beginning, it's called toast, and you'll be sniffing the char.
You start smelling kind of a baked bread smell. That's what we like. That's when we know we're getting a toast layer. And once we have the toast layer, we'll let the barrel ignite like that. You get baked bread, you get kind of marzipan, really, really nice smell.
The number of small craft distillers in the U.S., it's going up fast. There could be 700 out there.
Some of them call and say, I'm making whiskey. I've got my stills going and I need barrels, and I didn't think there would ever be a problem getting barrels.
At the Kelvin Cooperage in Louisville, they are working overtime. But the company estimates that in this year to come, they could sell all the barrels they could make 10 times over. Noah Adams, NPR News.
That story first aired on NPR's All Things Considered in December 2014. This is Inside Appalachia. Kentucky has its bourbon. Moonshine is making a big comeback in Appalachia. And it seems craft beer has an important backer. During his State of the State address in January, West Virginia Governor Earl Ray Tomlin touched on a bill he hopes will incite the growth of an already burgeoning industry in West Virginia, craft brewing. Dave Mistich of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
Beer, it's the everyman's drink. Fundamentally, it's just yeast, barley, and hops. But for Brian Arnett of Mountain State Brewing Company, located in Thomas and Morgantown, craft brewing, especially here in West Virginia, is something way more than that.
It's a revolution. It's a full-on revolution. It's people that want to know a story behind what they're consuming, and they like the story, and they like the different flavors, and they're provided variety and flavors and things that they would not get otherwise.
If you find yourself in a bar or restaurant in West Virginia, it's nearly impossible not to notice the influx of the state's craft beer offerings on taps, in bottles, and now even cans. Breweries have been springing up all over in recent years, in virtually every corner of the state. Morgantown Brewing Company assistant brewmaster Jesse Sedlock says his operation has grown tremendously since opening in 2009.
When I started here, they were producing maybe 300 barrels a year. This year, we're close to 1,500 barrels a year. So we've actually grown exponentially over the past few years. The draw for craft beer in West Virginia has grown greatly over the last few years. Again, just a few short years ago, there was only maybe 7 or 8 different breweries in West Virginia. This year, there's going to be 12. Next year, there's even more slated to open. So,
with such growth and even more opportunity, brewers began to realize their industry could benefit by banding together. They see competition as a good thing, so much so that Lincoln Wilkins of Blackwater Brewing Company and others had formed the West Virginia Craft Brewers Guild to support the industry as a whole.
We formed a Craft Brewers Guild about a year ago now. It's actually almost spot on a year, about the start of December 2013. And, you know, for a couple of reasons. To promote the craft brewing industry in the state of West Virginia, to make people aware of craft beer and what we're doing, and also to work legislatively, to promote hopefully a modernization of some of the craft brewing or some of the alcohol laws that are relevant to the craft brewing industry in the state.
In September, Wilkins and his fellow guild members took to the state capitol for an inner meeting of the legislature's Joint Committee on Economic Development. During that meeting, the group presented a list of desired changes to state law. Bill Rittenauer of Chestnut Brewing Company in Morgantown is relatively new to the state's craft brew scene,
and says the licensure process to become a resident brewer was arduous.
As I was going through it, I found it to be very lengthy. But then after it was all said and done, I looked back on it and I go, it wasn't too much. I don't know. I've never opened a business before, so it was tough to really gauge it. But it did feel long while I was going through it. It did feel long. But I'd say all in all, it took about 4 months, I would say, from when I submitted all my paperwork to when I was approved.
Aside from the lengthy process of submitting applications and receiving licenses, West Virginia craft brewers say the fees are too steep for those operating on a small scale and discourage others from starting their own operations. They also say limitations on growler sales and the ability to offer tastings or samplings is keeping them from becoming a bigger economic force. Rittenour says the labeling and alcohol analysis for new varieties could also be streamlined.
Right now, if I want to make an experimental beer, I need to make a test batch. Then I need to send out the samples for alcohol analysis, which is something I can measure and calculate pretty easily and pretty accurately with some of my equipment. But we need to get third-party verification of the alcohol analysis.
There's also this issue of distribution. Currently, brewers are allowed to self-distribute 1,000 barrels a year. But getting their beer to the masses and out to a wider radius almost always necessitates a distributor, regardless of the size of the operation. The problem is, they say, once they've signed a contract with a distributor, there's no way out of it. Arnett says some changes could be made to help brewers without hurting distributors in the process.
There's a natural relationship between a brewer and a distributor. Brewers will always use distributors. We'd self-distribute it ourselves, and to get in every nook and cranny in West Virginia and brew beer, it's way too much. So brewers will always find a natural relationship with the distributors. It doesn't need to be forced, you know. So, and brewers will always want to take care of their distributors. That's their customers. So there's a natural wanting to take care of a distributor from a brewer's standpoint. So it doesn't need to be enforced. That's
why tonight, with a bill backed by Governor Tomlin, brewers are likely to get some of the things they've been hoping for, including a sliding scale for the resident brewer's license fee based on volume of production. The governor's legislation includes provisions to allow the sale of 4 growlers at a time for off-site consumption instead of their current limit of 2. And lastly, brewers would be allowed to offer samplings and tastings on brewery tours, putting their industry on par with wineries and distilleries who already have that privilege. Lincoln Wilkins says that aspect can offer a huge boost to the industry as they try to market themselves as a force in what's known as ecotourism. With recreational tourism like rafting, hiking, and rock climbing available in the state, he says the craft beer industry could complement and augment the things West Virginia already offers.
I really do think that that ecotourism interface with craft beer is probably one of the most crucial aspects of what we're doing. And people want that, you know, they want to come in and they're experiencing the locale. They want that local flavor.
And that local flavor is what Wilkins and his fellow craft brewers say they can sell more easily with the help of West Virginia lawmakers. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich. Cheers.
A state bill relating to brewer, resident brewer, and brew pub licensing and operations has passed the House Small Business Committee and is awaiting action in the House Judiciary Committee. This episode, we've been talking about industries in Appalachia that are growing. Many of these industries aren't really new at all, but new practices are building on traditional crafts. While these changes develop across Appalachia, we inevitably want to hang on to our identity. Strong roots, after all, are one of the characteristics many of us take pride in. For our last story, we'll join in an adopted Appalachian tradition from immigrants that held on to their roots long ago. And once again, it's helping to revitalize the community. Today, we go to Helvetia, West Virginia, where every year the little town tries its best to frighten away Old Man Winter at its Fasnacht. Fasnacht takes place every year on the last Saturday before Lent, and this year it took place on February 14th on Valentine's Day. Our producer, Roxy Todd, attended the Fasnacht Festival last year, and she brought back this audio postcard from the Inside Appalachia Archives. Here's the story of a little town called Helvetia.
On Saturday morning, I woke to the smell of curry and countless other spices wafting up to my room above the Hute, where I was staying. And as I sat down for coffee beside the crackling wood stove, the smells grew more intense, and I could hear something frying in the kitchen. One of the cooks was frying the Morgan Henley chicken in olive oil, so I went to have a closer look.
I can't give the spices away. I can say this much. It's a curry chicken. It's marinated, and then Henry fries it, and it's we bake it, and that keeps it nice and moist.
Debbie has worked at the Hute since 1977, and like many here, her family roots go back to Switzerland.
Mostly, Debbie makes her homemade bread, and she's made it for years, and then Wilma Sanders makes our whole wheat bread. And the sausage is what a lot of people love. And we get that from Campbell's Market, shoulder sausage, very lean. And then we have nine different spices that go into it, grated onion and a whole bunch of other things that I won't tell you about. It's wonderful, and people love it.
Yeah, the two different sausages, they're different.
I'm Heidi Farner Mayhew Arnett. My mom was Eleanor Mayhew.
Since her mother, Eleanor Mayhew, passed away 3 years ago, Heidi and four others in her family have been keeping the restaurant going, just as before.
And we don't care. We don't want to make a dime. We just want to continue this. And the staff is amazing. They've been working with us for years.
Eleanor, she worked with the recipes over the years to get them where she wanted them. Quite a lady, wasn't she, Melissa? Yeah, we miss her. But we're doing what she taught us to do. And she worked hard to get, you know, to get us where we're at today.
Preserving the old ways of cooking Swiss foods wasn't the only tradition that Eleanor Mayhew helped inspire here. Bringing back Fasnacht was also part of her creative vision for reviving Helvetia.
Fasnacht is something that happened many years ago that they always celebrated. What they used to do, I think, is go to farm, and they used to have a glass of wine and a rosette or a Hoseblatz and go to the next house, and it was like a party. So many of the local families were musicians, and so they would play songs and hang out, and it was a lot of fun. That was one of the things also that my mom kind of wanted to get going back again, because it was something that they used to celebrate. So we had people sleeping on the dining room table, under the dining room table, and my mom was all for it. She loved kids.
After dinner, hundreds of people slip on their costumes and oversized papier-mâché masks and parade through the small town towards the dance hall. In circles and pairs, weaving beneath a scarecrow-esque effigy of Old Man Winter, they dance for hours.
It's always a hard winter here because we're in the mountains, so burning him is really therapeutic.
Everything on Old Man Winter gets burned every year. And square dancing, and that they love it so much, and it's a great thing to be a part of. So, yeah, we love it.
At midnight, someone cuts down Old Man Winter from the ceiling. Hallie Martin of Elkins Middle School is given the honor this year of hauling Old Man Winter onto the bonfire, amid cheers and howls from the crowd. In a way, this is West Virginia's Mardi Gras. It's 40 degrees, and Old Man Winter has been temporarily put to shame. Some of the local people begin to sing John Denver's Country Roads, and somebody throws a dead wild boar they found nearby onto the fire, and the flames grow higher. Maybe the burning of a wild boar and the singing of Country Roads will become new traditions, blending with all the others of Helvetia. It's for the next generation to decide what comes next here, anyway.
You know what I like about Helvetia is that you can be who you are. I love Helvetia people, and I'm Pickens people and Czar people. They're the purity of just being who you are. It's a freedom. You know, you're very free out here to be who you are.
Take me home to the land.
Happy Long, West Virginia.
And finally, the recent cold snap has kept many of us Appalachians indoors this past week. Many school systems have been closed for the entire week. And it's not surprising to me that several of the superintendents are delivering closure messages with a personal touch. Here's one from Keith Butcher, the Nicholas County Superintendent in West Virginia.
Clap along to this song if you're happy there's no school. Clap along if you feel like that's what you want to do. Due to weather conditions, Nicholas County schools will be closed on Friday, February the 20th. Thank you.
And who says we're unhappy here? Certainly brought a smile to my face. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Traveling 219, NPR, WCQS, and the Allegheny Front. Music in today's show was provided by the Glenville State Bluegrass Band, Andy Agnew Jr., John Wyatt, Walt Koken, and our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their CD, Sounds of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Because we've been hit with a lot of snow this past week, and although you might be sick of all this weather, we wanted to leave you with one more snow day song, courtesy of Keith Butcher from Nicholas County Public Schools. Stay warm, folks, and be well until we meet again inside Appalachia.
I got my ticket for the long way round. Someplace that's warm I'm going to stay. And I sure would like some great company. And I'm leaving tomorrow, what do you say? There's no school. This kind of weather just ain't cool. You're gonna miss the history test. You're gonna miss all the rest. Oh, you're gonna miss it, there's no school. Due to weather conditions, schools in Nicholas County will be closed on Thursday, February the 19th. Thank you.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at Concord.